Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, this is sort of relevant to the question I have to pose to people when we talk about what's going on in our gardens, but we're going to have Mel Bartholomew on the show. Pretty famous name, don't you
Very
think?
Very famous. Yeah,
you know, back from the 1980s.
A long time, yeah.
Early 80s. And,
yep.
You know, that used to not seem so long ago, but then when you count the decades, Bob, it's a really long time
ago.
Who
are you talking to, kiddo?
I know. I'm starting to feel a little old,
He endures like an asparagus patch. He's everywhere.
But he came up with this concept of square foot gardening. And, you know, more and more people are doing this in regular fashion than ever before. You know, back in the day, it used to be long rows planted out. So people probably thought he was a kook when he said, no, you can pack things in pretty tightly. So, yeah, if you have not yet been convinced to start your own little vegetable garden in the backyard, or if you have just started it this year, you'll definitely want to stick around to see what Mel Bartholomew has to say.
Yeah, and we reduced our garden from square acre garden to square yard. We're down to square foot pretty much now.
Are you good? Yeah. I pack it in there pretty good.
It's less weeds.
It is less weeds, absolutely. And our friend Tom Barnes from the University of Kentucky is paying us a visit in the studio to talk about one of his new books that's come out. It's co-authored with Deborah White and Mark Evans. Both of those folks are from the Kentucky Nature Preserve Commission. But the book is called Rare Wildflowers in Kentucky.
Yeah, I've got a monster wildflower gap I wish I could fill in because I'm around people who know so much. We had Tavia Cathcart on a little while ago, and she just walked the woods and point this out and point this out and point.
It's
I can do that with woody plants, but I sit there like an idiot around wildflowers. So it's a good book and great pictures. And again, I'm going to just try to learn more.
Yeah.
And go on trips. I think going on trips is almost essential.
Going other places to
see. And people walking in the woods with experts. Like Tom Barnes and Mark Evans.
Exactly. Absolutely. So stick around. That's coming up today on Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
I get this 90-foot climbing rose arbor. It's just absolutely fabulous. But when the climbing roses are done, they're done.
Yeah.
And I got clematis in there, clematis, we might say. And some of those kind of bloom at different times. So I'm working hard to get something for July, August, September, October on my climbing arbor. And I've had not mixed success with annual vines. So here I am an expert, but I'm kind of looking and searching myself to find something to make this wonderful 90-foot arbor live and be alive.
Well, one year, didn't you have some like squash or something
we
on
did.
There? And how did that work?
That was fun.
Okay.
It reminded me of that. And we also had baby pumpkins hanging down and growing off there. So there are things you can do, but I guess I'm just in search of every day I want something in that arbor.
Right.
And it's going to take some time.
Yeah. And when he says 90-foot arbor, it's like you walk through this tunnel, basically, of an arbor, you know, and it turns and curves, and
it's made out of cedar.
Rough-hewn
cedar. It's just a gorgeous structure.
It really is.
It's just beautiful every
it's
day
fabulous.
Of the year, but
yeah.
I'm working on that, so I'm just announcing to the public I don't know everything.
Yeah. And, you know, every day I realize
what are you going to announce?
What little I know.
What are you going to confess, Ms. Wishy?
Well, the peas are ready.
Oh, boy.
So that's good. But you remember,
they
and this
ready,
got me thinking, because remember we had one of our listeners, a question. She wanted to grow peas, but she sort of asked a little late because you start your peas pretty much in mid-March. Yeah. So you have an early harvest. And, you know, up to a certain point, we had a nice cool spring and then it turned warm and peas just don't like it hot. But long enough to establish and bloom really well, fabulously well. So I'll be bringing some sugar snap peas in for you guys shortly because the crop is on. But you want to get your peas. If you want peas now, you want to plant your peas in mid-March. And it looks like for the first time in my life, I might have a cutworm problem.
Oh, no.
So I'm back in the garden and my Momotaro tomato sliced at the base.
Oh.
And then my tomatillo.
Your chickens aren't doing the job. What's up with the chickens?
Well, and that's exactly what I did that evening when I've discovered all
this.
I'm like,
loose?
Babes, come on in.
Yeah.
Because everything is grown up enough and there aren't any areas where that is a desirable scratchy area where the crops are. So they'll just scratch, you know, around in different areas without destroying anything. Yeah. But yes, I said, girls, get in here.
Yeah. Put them in the timeout room if they don't. Get them cutworms.
But I had actually been keeping the chickens out because everything needed to sort of take hold before.
So what next? Now, once they've already cut them off, do you have time to regrow and get? Are you done?
It's the tomatoes done.
Oh, no.
And I did, and this is more of an experiment.
Call Ratterman.
This is a total experiment. I don't think it's going to work, but I couldn't help myself. So, because it was so healthy, the tomatillo looked so healthy. So, broken off. So, I just stuck it back into the ground. Because those types of things, I mean, you can't do that with any plant.
No.
But those are the types of things that could potentially root out again.
Willows and...
You sink them anyway, so...
I sink them way deep.
Yeah, and the tomatillo's the same way. So we'll see what happens.
We'll have the listeners say small prayers for tomatillo tomatoes from this
wishing. Oh, Lord, no kidding. So,
in Latin,
yeah.
Of course.
So, okay, ultimately, this is what I wanted to throw out to everybody. We've gotten so many questions, particularly this spring, with new gardeners, people starting new vegetable gardens for the very first time. I would totally love to hear from some of those people, or even if you've never even asked a question, go to our website. It's wfpl.org, and you know, go to Homegrown, and let us know what your first-year experiences are.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, I really, you know, because and it's like what you were talking about with the wildflowers. This is the best way to learn. Yep. Making mistakes, sure, kind of a pain in the butt, but it's the best way to learn. So if we can share our successes and our failures with one another,
Yeah, it'd also be kind of fun to go to the garden. We talk to experts and go out to people who are success stories.
We want to see your really failures. Good garden. Yeah, no kidding.
We want some failures on this show.
All right.
Unlike us.
We fail enough, I think.
I think so.
All right. Calendar. One, I got an interesting piece of information from out of Indiana. They now have available through Purdue an Indiana farm market and agritourism sort of list of everything. So you can go to Purdue's website and get more information on that. Bob, I'm going to be, and you're going to be here, be at the Habitat Restore place at a different date.
Yes.
But I'm going to be at Habitat Restore Saturday the 13th from 1 to 3. It's down there kind of by U of L.
Across from Papa John's.
Floyd Street across from Papa John's.
Yeah, can't miss it.
But we sort of, every year, Bob and I do like a little triage thing down there. To talk about plants and kind of bringing them back to life. So I'll be down there on the 13th, 1 to 3, and we'll keep us posted on when you're going to be showing up down there, Bob, okay?
I'll do it. If you're looking for something to do today, the Glenview Garden Club holds its garden tour today until 5 p.m., rain or shine. There's 6 early summer gardens will be on display. Tickets available at Dolls Market, Boone Garden or Garden Center, the Plant Kingdom, or Diggs Home and Garden, or see our website. Also, the Farmington Historic Plantation is proud to announce the presentation of the 2009 Ann Bruce Haldeman Award to writer, critic, and farmer Wendell Berry. He's being recognized for his dedication to preserving America's heritage and ecology. He'll receive his award at June 12th at 6:30 p.m. during Farmington's annual An Evening in the Garden. Again, go to our website for more information on honoring Wendell Berry.
That's right. Sounds good. And a visit to Farmington as well.
Yep.
They have a new garden out there. It's more of an ornamental garden. And if you're interested in the edible type, as we are, Mel Bartholomew is joining us now. He's the author of Square Foot Gardening, which was first published in 1981. The success of this new style of gardening led to a PBS series in 1987 and then a Discovery Channel series in 1992. In addition to the book, the Square Foot Method Foundation works with schools and has launched a global initiative to reach developing countries. Mel, welcome to Homegrown and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Janine.
Sure. You probably don't have a hard time convincing people today that you can grow more in less space, but back in the early 1980s, kind of when you first started doing this, did you get funny looks from people because you weren't using the long traditional rows that, you know, most people associated gardening with?
Well, actually, I invented the system thinking the experts will look at this and say, "Eureka, this is wonderful.
Uh-huh.
We can now shorten our rows, we can reduce our size, we won't have to hoe so many weeds," and so forth and so on.
Right.
And that's where I got the looks from the experts. The beginners looked at it and said,
"This makes sense.
I could do that."
Yeah.
That sounds easy. Yeah, is that all gardening is? It sounds simple. The gardener, the advanced gardeners and all the experts kept saying, gardening can't be that easy. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's a lot of hard work to garden, and I've spent my life doing all this hard work.
Yeah.
So, in fact, in our lectures, we tell people, if you're a beginner, you can learn the whole square foot gardening system in about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're an expert, it's going to take you about 2 weeks.
Very good point, sir. Very good point. Right,
yeah. Well, Mel, did you trip over a ruler someday or a yardstick? Or where does inspiration come from?
Well, first of all, I'm not a horticulturist, Bob.
Okay.
I'm a civil engineer,
And
I had retired from my engineering company and took up gardening as a hobby. So, and then all of a sudden, I found myself in charge of a community garden, and I had to start studying and reading pretty fast to keep ahead of the people because they were full of questions. And so I taught the traditional single-row method because that's what everyone learned.
Mm-hmm.
And as I watched our garden, our community garden, I began to see trends. Like great excitement in the springtime, lots of tools, lots of activity, brought the whole family, had a real field day every Saturday coming out, planting these long rows of everything, sprinkling out a whole packet of seeds along the whole row, and the next week they'd come back and say, well, what are we supposed to do now? They,
right.
they haven't sprouted yet. I said, well, I don't know, I guess we'll have to wait. And they said, oh, we can't wait. Maybe they're bad seeds. They plant another row of the same thing.
Oh.
And, of course, that just overplants. But then when they came back and I said, they've sprouted, now it's time to thin, and I'd read the back of the package, seed packet to them, and it says, thin to 6 inches apart. And we had just sprinkled 1,000 seeds along that
right.
long row.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to think in my mind, that a red flag started to go up. Why did we plant so many seeds when now we have to tear them all out?
Yeah.
And then I kept thinking, if the seeds are thin to 6 inches apart, why don't we just plant a pinch of seeds every 6 inches? And I thought, I'm going to invent a new way to garden. So I experimented for a year, and I came up with a concept where you walk around your garden and reach in.
Mm-hmm.
That means you don't step on your growing soil.
Mm-hmm.
Most people can reach in 2 feet, so if you walk all the way around it, that's a 4x4.
Mm-hmm.
And that has become the basic size of a square-foot garden.
Okay.
Now you can have as many of these as you want. One of the big breakthroughs in the new book, the old book, the original book, says dig up 6 inches of your existing soil and improve it with blah, 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 blah. Now we eliminate that completely, and you don't have to dig in your garden at all.
Hmm.
We build a box, a bottomless box. We put it on top of the ground, and we fill it with a perfect soil mix. And that's all you need for a garden.
So how deep is it?
6 inches.
So that seems not. So are we, when we're talking about the square foot gardening kind of thing, are we strictly talking about annual types of plants?
No, annuals, perennials, bulbs, anything you want.
Mel, it doesn't seem like enough soil.
Crops.
It doesn't seem like enough soil in my mind.
Of course
mind.
Not, because you're thinking single rows mm-hmm. where you have to improve your existing soil.
Mm-hmm.
I went to all the commercial greenhouses around the country, and they're growing tomatoes, peppers, flowers all in benches in the
mm-hmm.
greenhouse
mm-hmm.
on the ground and up on top of the benches, and their soil is only 4 to 6 inches deep. And I said, how can you do that? And they said, well, we start with a perfect soil.
Okay.
There you go.
So I thought, if you can do it in a greenhouse, why can't we do it out in our backyard?
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk.
I experimented, and I got the perfect soil mix. It's one-third peat moss, one-third coarse vermiculite, and one-third compost. Now, compost is the secret.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be a blended compost.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is, it has all the nutrients that the plants need.
Mm-hmm.
And now, here's number two great thing. You don't need fertilizer in your garden.
Mm-hmm.
We never add fertilizer to a square foot garden. All the nutrients you need are in that that blended compost. Mm-hmm. And it's only 6 inches deep.
Yeah.
And the plants grow just perfectly.
That's un-American.
But yeah, it does sound a lot easier for folks. I just worked up a potato patch back in the garden.
Uh-huh.
Lot of digging, you know, preparing that bed. So this is a great alternative for people that don't have space and don't have the ability to dig.
Yeah, I got a question. Say you're growing sweet corn or a vine crop or the watermelons where you normally have these 15, 20-foot hills. How do you deal with that?
Good question, Bob. We grow all the vine crops vertically. And if you look in our book, the all-new Square Foot Gardening book, or you can go to our website, squarefootgardening.com, and you'll see there how we build a vertical frame.
Mm-hmm.
And I like steel. I use steel. I don't like wood because it eventually breaks, cracks, whatever, and rots. So I use steel, And I show you exactly in the book, even with photographs, exactly how to do a vertical frame. And then on that frame, the original book said, put string on there. But I found string breaks after a while, but mm-hmm. now we have a wonderful nylon netting that's on the market. Mm-hmm. And you can buy this just about everywhere. And that never breaks. It's strong, and all the vine crops grow right up the top.
How about sweet corn? Now, you think of it?
Sweet corn is very easy to grow in a square foot garden. We fit four. All the new varieties are much smaller than the old fashioned, and we put four per square foot. You can plant one section at a time. We do a whole 4x4 if you like a lot of corn. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing is, it's very easy to protect. Again, you'll see in the book or on the website how to put chicken wire right around that 4x4 and a piece across the top, and the raccoons can't get in.
Keep the coons out.
I wondered about that, too.
Keep the coons out, yeah.
Now, realistically, how long would it take to establish this perfect compost blend that you're talking about?
Well, it would take probably about 3 to 6 months for a homeowner to get really good compost, but you can go to the market and buy it. Mm-hmm. You can go to all the big box stores like Home Depot and Lowe's, go to their nursery, or you can go to your local nursery. Now, here's the caution. Don't buy all of one kind of box, or don't buy all one bag of compost,
right.
Because invariably, people will point, and they'll look at the one little bag there that's only 99 cents, and they'll tell the guy, I'll take 10 of those bags.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not a blended compost. That's from one source.
Mm-hmm.
So we tell people, get five different kinds.
So that's what you mean by blended compost.
Yes.
Okay. So, Mel, in terms of upkeep, once you establish your 4x4 boxes and you've managed to get the perfect Mel's mixture of soil, is this something that we have to add to every year? Do you recommend using cover crops or any other types of things?
Well, you can
to maintain
put in
the boxes?
Cover crops, but you don't really need them, and it takes a little bit of work in the spring then to dig them under.
Mm-hmm.
What we recommend now, once you build your boxes, they're going to be good for a long time, and the nice thing is you can put a plywood bottom on and lift them up and put them on a tabletop.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if you're in a wheelchair, you can garden.
Mm-hmm.
If you're elderly, you don't have to bend over. You can stand up and garden or sit down. But once we never change the soil. What we do, you'll see, we have some garden tips you can download from our website. But if you add a trowel full of compost mm-hmm. every square foot mm-hmm. after you harvest it, now you can get at least three crops in most of the country, sometimes some four. And if you harvest one square foot, mm-hmm. put in a trowel full of compost, mix it in, very easy. All you need is a trowel. That's the only tool you need now.
So you're advocating a more organic approach then, too, in terms of your fertilization by adding
absolutely.
Compost to feed your plants throughout
absolutely.
The season.
For a couple of reasons. One, a lot of people like the organic, and mm-hmm. they like what we call it natural rather than organic. That mm-hmm. always scares people. They think they're back in the 60s.
Yeah. Or that it's too hard somehow.
Yeah.
Hippie gardeners.
And you can't grow much. But here's a way of explaining it to the experts, and then they'll understand it. What kind of organic matter do you have in your existing ground? What percentage? So if you go to your ag agents, they'll say, well, in this part of the country, we have 2 or 3 or 4% organic material. Mel's mix, because it's one-third from the compost, has 33%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's 10 times as much material that the plants need for nutrients. And it lasts for a long time. And as that breaks down, each time you change that crop, which is crop rotation,
mm-hmm.
you're adding to the soil, and that's soil improvement.
Mel, let's talk about rotation. Do you rotate year to different boxes from year to year?
Well, we rotate. First of all, Bob, we never plant the whole box in one thing. There's a few exceptions, but usually we try and plant a different crop in every single square foot.
Hmm.
A 4x4 with a grid on it, and a grid is very important because it keeps reminding you, you only have to do one square at a time. So if you plant a different crop in every square foot, you'll have something that, you'll have a garden that looks like a patchwork quilt.
So what's the advantage of having them all different?
Because it keeps you from overplanting.
Mm-hmm.
When you put in, you look in the book and you want to plant radishes at 16 per square foot, you decide which square you want to put your radishes in, you make your spacing, which is very easy, and then you pop in a pinch mm-hmm. of seeds in each hole, And when you're ready to thin, you take a pair of scissors and thin off the extra ones and leave just one good one in each spacing. And in 4 weeks, you know, you'll have radishes. Now, they'll last for about a week, and then they'll get too big and pithy. And I ask people, can you eat more than 16 radishes in 1 week? If so, that's a lot of heartburn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you were back
to
row gardening, you plant a whole row of radishes.
Gotcha.
That's too many. It's the same thing. If you planted a whole row of lettuce, 6 inches apart, a 20-foot row, that's 40 heads of lettuce all at once.
Well, do you literally run string to make your squares, and do you drill holes in the boxes for the drainage?
Neither. We put, if you have the plywood bottom, yes, you drill a hole in the bottom. You need one per square foot and an extra one in each corner. And then lift that up onto a tabletop or a brick wall or a block. And then it drains easily. The nice thing about Mel's Mix, it is truly a perfect soil. All the ingredients drain well.
Yeah, with the vermiculite. Uh-huh.
But they also hold water. Mm-hmm. See the difference?
Mm-hmm.
So they can hold the water for the plant roots, but when they get saturated, they won't get soggy.
Mm-hmm.
It drains right out the bottom. In the ground, Bob, going back to the grid idea, to divide up your box, and you can make the box out of wood or cement blocks or vinyl fencing or anything. When we go to a third world country, which we're heavy into now, doing a lot of humanitarian work, if we can't find wood, then we use rocks or bricks or cement blocks. But you put on a grid, and the best grid, the original book said string, it's no good. It breaks, it gets dirty, messy, and finally you take it off. So what we do now is we put on a rigid grid like a stick of wood. And you can go to the lumber store and get what they call lath,
mm-hmm.
L-A-T-H.
Mm-hmm.
Comes 4 feet long. They must have known we're going to use it. And it's perfect. You put three down this way and three down just opposite. You can drill a little hole right at the 12-inch mark, put a little nut or bolt or screw there, and you have a perfect grid that'll last forever.
Here comes Mel, that crazy man with the 4-foot boxes.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
Mel Bartholomew is the author of Square Foot Gardening, first published in 1981. A new and improved edition is now available through Cool Springs Press. Mel spoke to us from his home in Eden, Utah. Of course, you can find more information about all of this by visiting our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up after the break, Tom Barnes is in the studio to talk about his adventure searching for the rare wildflowers of Kentucky. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill.
And we have a special guest in the studio today, our friend Tom Barnes. I don't think we usually get so lucky to actually have him in person, so we're delighted to have him here. But Tom Barnes is an extension professor of forestry and wildlife specialist at the University of Kentucky, where he emphasizes conservation, restoration, and biodiversity. Tom's the author of several books, including Gardening for the Birds and Kentucky's Last Great Places. He's also the co-author with Wilson Francis of Wildflowers and Ferns of Kentucky, and most recently co-author with Deborah White and Mark Evans of Rare Wildflowers of Kentucky. Tom, welcome to Homegrown. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sure, we finally have you in person. Usually we either have you in Lexington studios or over the phone, so it's good to see you in person. Let's just sort of recap, because I was thinking when I was looking at the new book, Rare Wildflowers of Kentucky, the book that you had worked on several years ago, Wildflowers and Ferns of Kentucky, was there some sort of inspiration in terms of taking some of the detail out of that and putting it into a new form, you know, pulling out the really rare stuff and highlighting that?
Well, when we redid Mary Wharton and Roger Barber's book, we made a conscious decision to change some things. And we left some rare things in that book, realizing that some of those orchids might be a hook for people to go out and try and find them.
Sure.
But we expanded that book to include more native species, got rid of the exotics, got rid of shrubs and grasses,
mm-hmm.
to try and make it more of a user-friendly kind of beginner's guide. Actually, the inspiration for this book was from The Last Great Places, where I wanted to do a book focusing on the conservation of natural resources like The Last Great Places. And, of course, as a wildlife biologist, I wanted to do it with wildlife, but most of our rare critters are like freshwater clams or,
yeah.
you know, it's yeah, not real
exciting.
They don't
exciting. Translate yeah. In a photograph as well as
right.
a rare wildflower.
And so we figured, you know, a lot of people really like flowers. Uh-huh. And we had, you know, a reasonable species list of about 350. And the other advantage, at least that I thought of originally, was that Nature Preserves Commission tracks and monitors each species. So I thought it would be a relatively easy project to go out and get, you know, images that weren't necessarily for identification purposes, but focusing on the beautiful aspects of these plants, and have a conservation message similar to the Last Great Places. Mm-hmm. So that was really the inspiration, more than saying, well, we're going to take out things from a field guide mm-hmm. that people wouldn't see.
Tom, I want to back you up a little bit, because I'm passionate about plants and gardening and finding new varieties and cultivars, yet I know almost nothing about wildflowers. And I wonder if I'm unique in that respect. And where does your passion come from that's so focused, or maybe it's not, just on wildflowers?
Well, I'm not a botanist. My training, my formal training is as a wildlife biologist. My doctoral work was on the effects of secondary plant metabolites on energy and nitrogen metabolism in deer.
I saw the movie. Yeah,
yeah, it's real exciting stuff.
But no, as a kid, were you out there walking the woods looking at wildflowers? Where'd this come from?
I grew up in rural South Dakota. I grew up in a hunting family. I carried a, you know, I got a BB gun at 10 and started carrying a shotgun hunting pheasants at 12.
Yeah, been there.
But my passion, I guess, for plants and flowers began when I was working on my doctoral work in Texas and seeing the diversity of flowers that they had there just kind of sparked my interest. And so I guess that's where I kind of developed that interest in flowers and plants. And I'm a broadly trained ecologist. So, you know, I just started learning about them. I've had, you know, maybe one or two botany classes in college. And I found that photography was the way that I could learn them.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned in your book, in the lead, that you were really excited to find one new species in Kentucky, I think, and all the wandering around you've done. So talk about that a little bit, what that feels like.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty exciting because in many cases when we'd go out to a site, the plants would be gone. And I was out with a couple of my friends here from Louisville, and we were out in far western Kentucky and came across Linaria, which is a native toad flax. And we thought that it had never been documented in the state before. It wasn't in the literature. And we found a nice population of it. And, you know, that's kind of thrilling. But even more thrilling, I think, was the day that we found a population of a rare plant that had never been found before. And it was actually the biggest and best population in the state. And the same people, Chris and Susan, they think I'm crazy because, you know, I screeched on, this is in McCreary County on Rattlesnake Ridge. And, you know, I see these purple flowers and I'm like, that looks like Salvia urticifolia, you know, and I slam on the brakes and I turn around and I park, and, you know, they're all like, you know, and thank God they're nurses. And sure enough, it was, we found over 300 plants, most of them in flower. And it was just, I mean, I had photographed that species a couple of weeks earlier in Tennessee, but it was so great to find that in Kentucky, because the other two populations were pitiful, and one of them was probably going to go extinct because the forest was growing around the plant. Mm-hmm. So that was even more exciting than finding a new species.
I believe you.
so like, are you just like out there driving around cold, or do you get tips from people that you know, or do you have a little insight, or is it just?
Well, a lot of it, I mean, when I was working on the project, the Nature Preserves has
the database that you're talking about. Okay.
But just because you have a dot on the map, that doesn't mean it's diddly.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes the plants were gone. Sometimes, you know, the conditions weren't right, it's done flowering. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, about 2/3 of all the plants occur in less than 3 locations in the state.
Huh.
So just because you have a dot on the map doesn't necessarily mean anything. And yeah, when I'm driving or walking, you know.
Yeah, watch out if you see Tom driving down the road because he's paying attention to the sides.
You know, I have been known to pull over and stop and, you know, and look and check it out. And, I mean, that's how we found the Lunaria canadensis. It was in Ballard County. It was on a little rural road. And I'm like, what's that little blue flower? So I just pulled off to the next little place where I could pull in. We walked back and, you know, looked at it and photographed it. And we knew it was nothing that we had seen before. So I think that's how a lot of these things are found, is just kind of by coincidence and chance.
But what's the process to both protect and document this plant if somebody else might come along next week and pick it?
Well, typically, I mean, if you have something rare and you know that it may be something you haven't seen, the best thing is to get it identified. And there are lots of people that can identify it. And if it is something rare, then contact the Nature Preserves Commission, because then they'll put it in their database and they'll, you know, for example, sometimes we find plants that are more common than we thought. The southern crabapple, which is a beautiful native flowering crabapple, was taken off the list because they found it in enough locations that they felt it was secure. So it's good to know that so that, you know, databases can be updated.
So if we were interested in conservation, what can the average gardener do really to try to encourage healthier populations of these rare and endangered species?
Well, from a gardener standpoint, the first thing you can do is not dig them. We have a horrible problem in this state with digging plants. I mean, we have a situation where we still are the largest producer of ginseng in the country. And, of course, we have very, very poor laws in the state protecting plants. It's not against the law to dig plants on private land. You can, of course, get arrested for trespass, but, you know, not necessarily for digging plants. And so ginseng, because the populations are declining, and it's certainly not rare yet, you know, the State Department of Agriculture put some limitations on when it could be sold or when it could be bought. You know, the theory being that, you know, after September or whenever the berries dropped and you dig the roots and the plants would reproduce because they dropped the berries. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had a little sting a few years ago. And, you know, none of the major dealers, I mean, they all got arrested. They're all buying it all times of the year, you know. I mean, because that's part of our culture. And Kentucky lady slipper orchids, yellow lady slipper orchids, again, they're not even rare. I don't even tell people where those are typically because people will go out and dig them. And so that's the very first thing is to, you know, protect what's there. And then I think the other thing that they can do is they can look at their lifestyles of their neighbors and in communities to try and create a more sustainable environment such that we don't have to develop so much land. You know, just south of Louisville in Bullitt County, one of my co-authors, Mark Evans, I think it was in the early 80s, was looking at this area called Pine Creek Barrens along Kentucky 480. And he was looking at from some old aerial photographs and found this huge area of dolomitic limestone glade, which only occurs in the western outer bluegrass. Well, it just so happens we have two endemic plants in the state. One of them is the white-haired goldenrod. The other one is the Kentucky gladecress. The Kentucky gladecress only occurs in southern Jefferson and northern Bullitt counties. He thought he found the mother lode from this aerial photograph of this huge natural area. Of course, when they got out there in the early 80s, of course, it was all, a lot of it had been subdivided. They were still able to protect several hundred acres. But within the last decade, the development pressure on northern Bullitt County has been so great that the populations of that glade crest have declined by more than 75%. And it's all due to development. And that's the only place this plant occurs in the whole world.
Well, Tom, are the native plant nurseries helping to some extent to prevent people from going out and plucking from the wild? They can get the seeds, and are people growing these legally and honestly?
Yeah, there are some good nurseries that have a lot of this rare stuff that you can purchase for your garden. You know, we've learned how to propagate the native lady slipper orchids, the ones that you can grow in the garden, including the rare Kentucky. But typically, because it takes 7 years for them to produce a flower, you know, they're not cheap.
I asked that question because one of the flowers I saw in your book was Great name, Running Buffalo Clover. Sounds like a Native American.
Beautiful, too.
It's just this, you know, salmon and pink and green and ivory and white on a clover. Of course, it's a close-up. I have no idea how big the flower is. But is something like that commercially available at some point? Is it worth growing? Or?
Well, I think it's worth growing. But, you know, so many of these rare plants have such exacting requirements.
Right.
You know, both of the native clovers we have in the state are both rare. Both regular running buffalo clover and running buffalo clover. And the issue with running buffalo clover, that was associated with bison and bison right. creating disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that one is a good one or not for cultivation, probably not. Some of these we don't know how to grow. Others we do. In my yard, I had over 250 species of wildflowers, a lot of them on the state list that I picked up from nurseries from around the East that would grow here, that I knew would grow here. They just weren't local genotype.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the thing, too, I guess, to think about and to find out which plants will actually be suitable to the backyard that you have, right? Then you won't fail so much if you choose the right thing for the right garden.
Yeah,
setting.
And I mean, some of the, you know, for example, many of the prairie plants that are rare are quite easy to grow, and mm-hmm. they're quite easy to grow in a yard. Other things are not, but Kentucky, a lot of our rare plants were at the edge of their range. And so, for example, you know, there's an interesting plant called Canada Burnet.
Mm-hmm.
It grows primarily at Bad Branch. It's a northern species. It actually is easy to grow in Kentucky. And, you know, I grew mine in a whiskey barrel full of peat moss and sand that was wet.
Uh-huh.
Because when you get up north, you get up into northern Michigan, it's a ditch weed.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
So, you know, it does just fine here if you give it the right habitat. Okay.
So, and you had mentioned, too, and that just sort of illustrates it as well, the northern, southern sort of thing, but that many of the plants that are rare in Kentucky aren't necessarily rare in Tennessee, for example. And is it just because of climate and
yeah, it's because okay. of range.
Okay.
You know, Kentucky is not really north. We're not south. Mm-hmm. We're not east. We're not west. And so, you know, we get mixing of a lot of flora. And what we end up getting is plants that are on the northern edge of their range or on the southern edge of their range or on the, you know, eastern or western edge of their range that we have some kind of a microhabitat situation that allows them to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, those plants, and this is when I give programs, I tell people those plants are the most important ones to protect because they're under more environmental stresses than it would be in the normal range. So, for example, the little white prairie lady slipper orchid typically grows up north and it's a wetland plant. In Kentucky, it grows in a limestone slope clade, which is hot, dry,
completely
shallow
yeah.
soil. And, you know, because of that, that may harbor the genetic material as our climate gets warmer and warmer. That may hold the genes that hold the survival to that plant.
Mm-hmm.
So those plants at the edge of their range are the most important to protect because they have the opportunity to change and adapt more than those that are in the kind of the
in
middle.
In a comfy zone.
Right, exactly.
Well, Tom, other than your book, of course, where would you recommend that our listeners go to satisfy their curiosity about wildflowers? What groups, what organizations? What?
Well, there's obviously the Kentucky Native Plant Society, which okay. is a group that promotes the conservation of native plants, education of native plants. We have a spring and a fall meeting every year. Usually the spring meeting is in the mountains. Usually the fall meeting is more in the west.
But will newcomers be intimidated by being
no,
around?
No, they cater to all. I mean, they okay. have people that take you out on hikes that just love to do that.
Right.
I think another way, believe it or not, I'm working on a book on finding and photographing Kentucky wildflowers.
There you go.
And even here in Louisville, Cherokee Park in the spring has an incredible wildflower display.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's as good as a lot of places in rural areas.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, you can find local parks and oftentimes you'll find somebody if you contact the Native Plant Society that might be interested in helping you develop an interest. Obviously, you can go to those kinds of resources that out there, that, you know, field guides and books to help you get interested. I mean, that's how I started learning plants was, you know, photographing them and then having to look them up and dice, you know.
Yeah, and be confused. I'm not sure if it's this one or if it's this one, you know, yeah.
And you know, even those that are more interested in getting more serious, the Native Plant Society has a series of certification courses. I think Bernheim does some of the same things with wildflowers and learning wildflowers. So I think those are the kinds of avenues that beginners can go and start with.
And it's probably the best way to do it with other people that have a mixed sort of experience so that you can learn from them in that kind of hands-on sort of way. Because picking a flower and a leaf sample and then going back to your book all by yourself, which I have done many times, can be really confusing and consternating.
Yeah. I know. I'll not forget when the first Wildflowers and Ferns came out, not the rare one. I was at a book signing in Moorhead, and this woman came up to me and she said, "Oh, I just love your book. My husband's a lawyer." And he couldn't understand why I was so enthusiastic. And since your book is organized in such a great way, you know, by season and color, I gave him a copy of the book and we went out and he could identify things. And he said, "Now I can see why you're so enthusiastic."
Yeah.
And I thought, great, we made a convert.
Really, it really does help, because that's what I've referred to so often. If we found something out in the field, okay, it's summer and it's yellow. So I can open up to the summer and the yellow section and see if I can find it. So good job there, Tom, for sure.
Yeah, I think, you know, the more people get out and just hike around and walk around and look, and instead of, you know, when you're hiking, instead of trying to go from point A to point B, try to go from point A to A1 to A2 to A3. You know, take your time, stop and smell the roses, so to speak. But, you know, look at the natural world around you.
Look at that's the best advice anybody could give us, I think. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Tom Barnes is an extension professor of forestry and wildlife specialist at the University of Kentucky. He's also the co-author with Deborah White and Mark Evans of Rare Wildflowers of Kentucky, published by University of Kentucky Press. For more information on Rare Wildflowers of Kentucky, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishing.
We have two fabulous questions.
Oh, do we?
We do.
And then we have a fabulous plant story.
We do.
Okay.
First one's for you, Miss Wishy, because you're the neem expert around here.
Okay. You're beginning to be, though. You're starting to use it.
I'm using neem.
Okay.
This is from Heather. Sorry, Heather. It's an inside joke. I am growing a vegetable garden for the first time this year. I want to keep it chemical-free. I've planted some plants to keep away the bugs, but I read up on neem oil after hearing about it on your show. It sounds like something that could be used in the home garden without any ill effects, as long as 100% pure neem. Is it okay to use it?
Yes, absolutely, in the vegetable garden. But, you know, I think she's on the right track, you know, planting. It's not necessarily that certain plants keep bugs away, but certain plants attract beneficial insects that then prey on the pesky ones. And, you know, when we say no ill effects, you can sometimes, you have to be mindful, because you can still kill good insects with, you
right.
know,
neem.
With neem. Yeah. But typically, it doesn't have as broad a spectrum as some other things in terms of killing everything. So, yes, neem is great to use as a last resort when picking and squashing the bug doesn't work. Using row covers, other types of things doesn't work. So, you know, we don't want to overuse the product by any means.
And I also read, I think, that neem doesn't last as long. You need to spray more frequently with it than you might with an organic.
It may, but one of the things that's different about neem than some of the other organic, you know, like horticultural oil or whatever, is that in fact it does have a systemic action to it. So it can, you know, the oil can be taken into the plant and help to control in that residual sort of way. But no ill effects in terms of what, it's food grade basically, no ill effects in terms of what we would eat afterwards.
You don't grow a third hand after.
Yeah, exactly.
Heather had a part two of her question, too.
Okay.
She has a severe deer infestation. She's been using stinky spray to keep them away from the plants. If she uses it around the garden, will it make my vegetables stinky as well?
Well, if you spray the plants, your plants may be stinky. And if you spray your fruit may be stinky.
But you can wash it off.
But if you, yeah, and like you can, basically, I would just spray the perimeter to deter the deer. And the problem is that if the deer wants your tomatoes or wants your beans or whatever, they're gonna take what they want, no matter what. So you might want to try to create some sort of barrier. You could try using fish line. I mean, you don't have to go the extreme that I went and have an 8-foot fence built around your vegetable garden.
Right.
But you can, you know, put poles up and then string the monofilament line, is that what it's called?
Yep.
The fishing wire. You know, around. They don't see it. And then when they touch it, it startles them away. You know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Otherwise, the deer just hold their noses and come in and
exactly.
get the stinky
and
vegetables.
Eat what you want.
Yep.
All right. One other question, Bob. This one's from Kathy. She has an infestation of azalea lace bug. This
Uh-oh.
Is the time that we see azalea lace bugs. She can't seem to get it under control. She's using an organic spray on the foliage, but it seems like the problem's not getting any better. In fact, spreading to adjacent azaleas. They're large azaleas, and she has a hard time getting the spray on the underside of the foliage as recommended. So she's wondering if there's something else she should try to get this under control.
There are times you just have to punt, I think, and use a... The other kind of spray.
The other kind of spray.
Not neem.
Not neem.
Yeah.
I have to agree here. If you have a really bad problem and you can't, I mean, and I don't know what kind of organic spray she's using, but neem, in fact, does work.
Right.
You can use horticultural oils as well to smother the insect, but since you are having a hard time getting it where it needs to go, which is on the underside of the foliage, you may, in fact, need to use a conventional systemic insecticide like malathion.
Maybe just once or twice and then go back to neem.
Yeah, and then check again in early May next year to see if there's any activity. And, you know, basically you just want to nip it in the bud earlier than later.
Okay.
All right.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 502-814-8246 or write us at 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202.
Plant story day. Bob, what do you have?
Hypericum.
Hypericum, St. John's wort.
I have trouble growing that plant.
Really?
Consistently have trouble growing that plant.
I have a fabulous one right now.
I don't know what the problem is.
Huh.
It's a very popular plant with reason, I think.
Drainage,
there's more than
maybe.
400 species.
Uh-huh.
Kind of low-maintenance perennial, kind of shrubby, those yellow flowers,
uh-huh.
about you know midsummer always. Has some ornamental fruit, some of them, so it's a good plant to have, but for some reason, not for Bob.
Hmm.
The other name, of course, is St. John's wort. Refers to John the Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
Because
it often blooms in June, the month John lost his head, unfortunately.
Whoops.
Yeah. And the yellow petals, I don't know this, they bleed red when they're crushed.
Because he lost your head.
Exactly. And there's the translucent spots on the leaves are supposed to be the tears shed for his death.
Huh.
The Bible also said that John lived on locusts and wild honey, and locusts would often land on Hypericum, so go figure. The word Hypericum comes from the Greek hyper, as in over, an icon as in picture.
Mm-hmm.
Named so because it was hung over pictures. It was a powerful deterrent to evil.
Hmm.
So they hang Hypericum over their pictures. It was used during medieval times to treat wounds, used for bug bites, skin irritations, burns, relieve bedwetting in children, of course. And the Native Americans, but you know this, used it in a tea for treating respiratory ailments and tuberculosis. Also, if you placed a sprig under the pillow on St. John's Eve, a saint would appear in your dreams, guaranteeing another year of life.
Hmm.
And who could you sue if you were wrong?
And don't people take it for, like, depression and stuff?
Yep, depression also, yeah. So, a poem.
A poem.
Oh, for the days of Hypericum, if all was bad and gray and glum, just go eat some yellow flowers, and ye shall regain all missing powers. No need to shop across the sea, or even the local pharmacy. One could just go to the old backyard without any need of a Medicard. Or if you feared your very house was haunted, you could carry on unscathed, undaunted. Just place the flower in the hall, way up high upon the wall. And all bad spirits who came your way would find another place to play. An ancient plant whose enchantment we missed, although not always so for John the Baptist.
Very nice. You know, Nico Case has a great song about John the Baptist, if anybody's interested. mention some of the things that you mentioned, in fact.
Well, it's an old story.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on this show, Joe Pappalardo and the social, political, and economic history of the sunflower.
Of
How about that?
Yeah.
All right.
Homegrown is produced by the ghost-chasing Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishey. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.